Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. You may have noticed a shift from our normal format in last week's episode on our new regional conference in Montgomery, Alabama, with founding member Ray Anthony Shepherd. Over the next few weeks, we will be taking a closer look at Bio as an organization. We wanted to peel back the curtain and introduce some of the people who voluntarily sustain us. Bio is growing by leaps and bounds, and there is so much to share as we move into our 15th annual conference season. Today, I wanted to share with you a conversation I had on Zoom in February 2025 with James McGrath Morris, who, as you will soon hear, was pivotal in bringing biographers together more than 15 years ago through a newsletter that continues to thrive today. Jamie is a prolific and award-winning biographer. His books include Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, The First Lady of the Black Press, Pulitzer, A Life in Politics, Print, and Power, and The Roseman of Sing Sing, a true tale of life, murder, and redemption in the age of yellow journalism, among others. Jamie is a former president of Bio, and in 2019, he was the recipient of the prestigious Bio Award. I began our conversation by asking him what the biography world looked like before Bio was formally organized.
I guess most of us start that kind of discussion with 1975, when Bob Caro published The Power Broker. For a variety of reasons, it really changed the field of biography. And one of the things it did is it, I think in many respects, made it more commercially interesting to publishers. And publishers are very much like generals. They fight each war based on their experience in the previous war. So when they see a form that's successful, they all rush to it. And then when that peters out, they rush to something else. But in the 80s and 90s, you know, biography was really in a heyday in many sense. Independently written biographies that were readable, interesting, that didn't necessarily have that long chapter, which I used to call the begatting chapter. You know, you'd read an interesting first chapter and suddenly you'd sink, as they said. Well, five generations before, his great-great-great-grandfather cut a tree down and he was related to so, and it just went on. That disappeared. Books became smarter and sharper to read. So I entered the biography field in 99 or 2000. I'm trying to remember. I don't remember when my first book was published. But I got a big contract from HarperCollins to write a biography of Joseph Pulitzer. Not knowing it, but that's what it led to the creation of the Biographers Organization.
What was missing in your life that Bio, like the creating of Bio, filled?
That's a very easy question to answer. Collegiality. Like any field, we work alone, and we might hire somebody temporarily to do a little research for us. Some of the more successful authors sometimes had a full-time assistant, but other people who knew what our problems were like, other people who understood how weird it is to live somebody else's life day in and day out, to get up in the morning and be in the shower and thinking about your subject, to come to the dining room table and not quite be present. In my case, I always talked about a ménage à trois and that my wife had to share me with somebody else. And she agrees with that. She thinks it's very much true. It's a different kind of writing than history is. Not that historians aren't compulsive about their work, but you're trying to understand somebody else's life. You're trying to get inside them, and that's a little different. So those are the kinds of things that, you know, you get two biographers and two cups of coffee together, and they thrive. And that's one of the reasons that we got around to creating Bio.
When you were thinking about structuring a nonprofit organization that supports biographers and their work, what were some of the things that you dreamed of in those first meetings?
Well, in some ways, we're getting ahead of the story because the creation of Bio was still several years away. I got this large contract from HarperCollins from an editor named Tim Dugan, who's actually now served on the board of Bio. A wonderful editor who gave me enough money to be able to leave high school teaching and go off and write for several years this book. And one of the pieces of advice he gave me is make sure you do something else. Don't just work on the book all the time. So in 2005, I think it was, I launched a newsletter called The Biographer's Craft, and I sent it filled with typos to my address book. I'm an awful proofer. I've always been a bad proofer. I'm not embarrassed to admit it. And I got a lot of remarks back, such as, really interesting stuff here, but you might want to work on your typing. And my theory was to create a newsletter that wrote about biography in a journalistic fashion, that I quote unquote, as a reporter would say, I covered these things. So a new book, a new technique, as long as it was covering biography, it should show up in the biographer's craft. And I did that from 2005, and 3 years later in July, probably June, I lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico, actually north of Santa Fe, in a neighborhood filled with dirt roads. And I was taking a walk one day, and I thought to myself, you know, biographers don't get together, but romance writers do, mystery writers do, thriller writers do, all kinds of groups. And so I wrote an open letter to biographers on the top of that issue of TBC, which at that point I think had 3,000 readers. And I said, you know, we really ought to think about putting together an organization to serve established and emerging biographers. And I got a lot of positive reaction to it. So in March of 2009, thanks to David Nassau, we got the use of a classroom at the CUNY building on Fifth Avenue. And about 50 people showed up, many of whom were very accomplished biographers whose names were instantly recognizable, and others who weren't, but hard at work in it. And we decided to go ahead and launch an organization. I agreed to spend 5 years on it, but that I would leave the positions, whatever positions I took. I ended up being executive director, I ended up being president, I ended up being on the board. I had a variety of jobs. And the reason I did that is that having been a reporter in Washington, D.C., I had observed quite regularly that good organizations created by people collapsed when the creator left the scene, that they stayed with the organization too long. It was too organizer-centric or founder-centric. And so I wanted from the start people to know that there would be a vacuum, that if this was to work, it would depend on other people to make it work. I couldn't just alone make it work. In May of 2010, that would be the following year, we held our first conference at University of Massachusetts, Boston, and Gene Strauss was our inaugural speaker. And three of us, basically, I'm not diminishing, there were tons of volunteers and a great number of people, but three of us really were the key to this. Ray Shepherd, Nigel Hamilton. And it was classic. I took a train up from New York and met them at the campus in the cafeteria. And we took out paper napkins and we wrote down a schedule. What would it look like? Who should we have? What would be the topics? What would be the panels? All on, you know, yellow on red markers and little scraps of paper. And thanks to Nigel being associated with the university, we were able to get this large room and a lunchroom and all these kinds of things. I remember standing in the back of the hall, and the hall was filled, and everybody was at round tables, and Jean Strauss was speaking, and she was on a big screen behind everybody. I didn't have texting then or anything like that, but I remember thinking if I could talk to my wife right now, I'd say, we did it. It happened. And I got very emotional at that moment, and bio became a reality from then on.
What were some of the things that you decided that were going to recur every year? And how were you able to keep people coming back and grow the organization?
The first few biographers conferences were really manned or staffed by volunteers and me arriving in town with boxes of printed programs and a, you know, cart and a rental car and driving around madly to photocopy and things like that. We had lots of volunteers, so I don't want this to sound like I was a traveling salesman bringing this on, but we were still building a board. We put together a board. We got people to agree to be on it. We had our interim president, then we had a regular president. And it grew from there. I think the answer really doesn't lie in me. I think the answer lies in the fact that there was a need for this. All you had to do was listen, and people particularly wanted practical panels, not the theory of biography. Many academic centers have done that, and they do a fine job on theories of biography, what I call it, life story writing, and things like that. Most of our folks want to know what's a good tape recorder, how do you duplicate images, what kind of filing system do you use, how the hell do you do end notes that you don't have to redo when you turn them in, who's a good agent, what editors are, the real nitty-gritty of this stuff. And we stuck to that. We've expanded it since, but that I think was always the core of it. And it's interesting. It's a point of amusement and joy to me. My first conference, and several of them, were called the Complete Biographers Conference, spelled the old British way, complete. This was modeled on The Complete Angler, a very famous book about fishing. And the idea of using that term is that you could come to the conference and learn everything you needed to know to do a biography and leave in doing that. Well, after I ceded power after several different posts, the new group of people who took over immediately abandoned that name. And I had two reactions. One was, oh, I really like that. Oh, that means bio is operating on its own, that it's a living, functioning organism, and I don't have to worry about it anymore. It's like when your child grows up enough to say no to you. And, well, they always say no to you when they're little, but you know what I mean, to make their own decision. And that was really wonderful for me. That was really a turning point.
So then you thought of creating an awards ceremony around the bio conference every year. Some of those awards include the Chip Bishop Award,
Yeah.
and then there, of course, is the Shepherd Award, the Volunteer, the Service Award. Tell me about the need for that, or what were you trying to accomplish with these awards?
Well, let's start with the first big one, the Bio Award. I took a lesson from being a reporter in Washington, D.C. All these interest groups got amazing speakers to come. Judy Collins performed at one place. Famous writers talked at their conference. And I thought, how are they affording these people? Right? I mean, some authors demand $20,000. The way they afforded them was to give them an award. That's how I invited Jean Strauss and invited everyone subsequently. I said, we, an organization of your colleagues, your compatriots, biographers just like you, would like to vote in honor of you to award you with the Bio Award. And the condition for getting it is, guess what? You got to come to the conference and speak. We did have a check tied to it, but it was not a lot of money. And we did pay their train ticket or plane ticket. But what really made it a success is, think about it. I mean, it doesn't matter how famous you are as a biographer and how many awards you get. To be recognized by your compatriots in this manner was very appealing. And so we've always been able to get. We also did it very carefully. We tried to make the first three, four, five of them be very representational of the diversity of our organization. And that way, by the fifth year or something, we were viewed by everybody as a very inclusive organization. We hadn't had the same male white speaker up front all the time. That also gives you freedom later to have the same white male speaker a few times because you're known as an inclusive group. And I think we pulled that off. Then because of I was really inspired by Ray Shepherd. He just did so much to get the conference off the ground, living in Boston. I don't know if we'd have been able to pull it off as well without him, that I suggested that we have an award for somebody's volunteer work named after him and modeled after him. And I said, it doesn't have to be given every year, but it's a way of highlighting somebody's particular donation. The next award I was involved with was Chip Bishop. Chip Bishop lived on Cape Cod. He ran a small advertising agency with his wife and I believe his son. And he'd always wanted to write biographies. And he came to the first biographers conference, bio conference in Boston. I met him then. In a matter of a few years, he got his agent. He met at the conference and he got two biographies published by Lion Press through his agent. And then sadly, Chip Bishop died very young. But before he died, and we were talking, he said that the biographers organization, Bio, had given him his new career and made it possible. And the conference in particular had been the key to it. So I have funded a prize that every year makes it possible for somebody who can't afford to come to the conference to be able to come to travel to the conference from England or wherever they may be, in the spirit of what Chip Bishop would have loved to have seen.
How has bio affected the publishing industry since its founding?
Well, I think one of the most noticeable change is that the Pulitzer Prize givers have now created a separate award to separate what the biography award that the Pulitzer Prize used to go could also go to a memoir or an autobiography. This has been a big issue for biographers. Sometimes I compare it, and I hope nobody who's Protestant or Catholic will take offense to this, but there's a big debate between those two churches about the nature of the wafer. That's what creates the conflict between the two churches, centers on the wafer. The conflict that existed for biographers is you go into Barnes and Noble, Borders, which used to exist, and there were these shelves labeled biography, and you'd pull down a memoir of a rock star or an autobiography of a politician. And we say, these are not biographies. What are we mixed up together? You don't mix up mystery with literature. So that change was prompted by bio, and I think it's helped make it clearer to people what biography is. Biography is an independently work or independently conducted work on somebody's life. In fact, the way I when I taught this subject, I used to start off by explaining that memoirs are sitting down with a typewriter or a computer and recalling your past. And the act of recalling it is almost as important as the actions that took place. We become engaged in that action, that memoir, that memory device. The next version of telling a life is an autobiography. And that's where, in theory, the person who's writing it makes some effort to determine facts. Henry Kissinger or a president writing an autobiography will have an assistant look up in the calendar. You ate lunch with Netanyahu on a particular day. You had coffee with Tip O'Neill on a particular day. So the autobiography is usually footnoted, or if not footnoted, you can count on those things being accurate. The pinnacle of all of this is a biography in which the biographer is making those decisions based on their research independently done. So no matter what the subject feels, if they're still around, the work stands independently of that person. There are authorized biographies, but that's a different field than biography. Unauthorized biographies is really what we all do. I mean, Kitty Kelley is obviously the most brilliant and well-known unauthorized biographer. But when it comes to it, we're all doing unauthorized biographies. We're not asking the subjects for their permission or asking them what we can quote and can't quote. The writing of biography, I think, is at a crisis point. It's just not enough money. It's as simple as that. The Medicis of our craft for a long time have been the powerful editors and publishing houses. They can't offer us the same kinds of money they used to offer. They're offering the successful biographers large sums that have increased in exponentially, but as a cost to mid-list writers, those of us who are not selling those kinds of mass bestseller books. And we need the money to support the work unless you have your own money or retired or something or a professorship. And that's what's happening is that you look at my advances or anybody else's advances, they've gotten smaller and smaller over the last 20 years, over the last 25 years. And the pattern is that that money has been going more and more to the best-selling authors. Now, don't begrudge it. It's a reality of the economics of book publishing. It's the same way that if you've been to the movie theater recently, you need to know your Roman numerals to know what version of this sequel is this. Is this sequel number 12 or 17? Because they make money and they're safe. And it is safer if you're running a major publishing house in New York City to decide to reinvest in the authors that have made you the most money than to take a chance on others. And that's really hurting our craft. We have to come up with some way to balance that.
Any ideas?
And most of the ideas I have are similar to what people are trying to do to save journalism. They're good, but they may not last for a long time. We're not going to be able to change the publisher's mind to increase the money because biographies aren't selling as well as a whole. It's a genre that's selling less and less. And there are complicated reasons why. I mean, I love Wikipedia. I'm not knocking Wikipedia, but I'm 70, and when I was a young person, I remember my family or myself buying a biography that maybe I wasn't going to read, but I felt an imperative to have this biography of Grant on my bookshelf so that someday I could pull it down and read. There's no need to anymore. You can go online and find very good work that's biographical about subjects that's trustworthy and noted. So that's certainly taken a dent. What I've looked at is journalism, is closing up shop in towns all over the country, like in St. Louis, where Pulitzer got his start. They're now nonprofit news centers. In fact, there's one in Washington, D.C., named after Pulitzer, that are not-for-profit organizations that do reporting, investigative reporting, foreign reporting, environmental reporting, all kinds of reporting. And they're sustained by donations and grants. And it's a viable format depending on how it works. In my home state of New Mexico, Searchlight is such a center, and the newspapers and radio stations and TV stations use their work, but it's produced by Searchlight independently. And I think that biography is going to increasingly depend on nonprofits providing the funds to write the book.
Fascinating.
Depressing, too.
That was James McGrath Morris talking with me about his invaluable work here at BIO. For more information on becoming a BIO member, including information on student memberships, visit our website, biographersinternational.org, and click on the Join tab. Memberships start at just $30 a year and include a monthly subscription to the publications that Jamie started more than 15 years ago. I'm BIO member and producer Jenny Skoog in New York City. Our executive producer is Sonia Williams. Darren Nesblitt created our theme music. Thank you so much for listening.